It's the takeaway for June 27th.
Because I can trust myself, I can extend trust to other people, and that whole experience has been so freeing for me. I'm no longer living in a state of fear, I'm living in a state of love.
What the future holds for two women in recovery in the conclusion of our series, Life After Overdose. Also on the podcast, tomorrow marks 50 years since the Stonewall riots and the birth of the modern LGBTQ rights movement. Plus, comedian Rami Youssef talks about his process and how he approaches identity in his work.
As I make more seasons on my show, but hopefully as there are other shows that revolve around other Muslim experiences, we can just be weird. You know, we don't need to do the work of re-educating. We don't need to do the work of reframing.
And let's get going.
I don't know why I survived all those overdoses, but I plan on helping as many people as I can.
If what we learned here and how we came together here, we can address addiction as a whole community, that will be the success story.
Well, what is it that I want to do for the future?
A lot of opportunities get closed to you. For a long time, I had a lot of dreams about what I wanted to do and all this stuff, and really, I just want to be happy, whatever that looks like.
All this week on The Takeaway, we've been looking at the opioid crisis in Ohio through the lenses of two women, 25-year-old April Arion and 41-year-old Lauren Hamilton and their families. Both women overdosed on opioids in a state that's been crushed by the epidemic of overdose deaths. And both women survived. New data this week from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggests that drug overdose deaths overall in the U.S. could be starting to fall. But while fewer people are dying, many people are still overdosing and getting revived thanks to the drug naloxone, which is more widely available today than ever before. But the stories of people like April and Lauren didn't stop at overdose. They survived, and with their families, they've had to navigate life in the aftermath. Today, we conclude our series, Life After Overdose, by looking ahead. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And we begin outside Cleveland for one piece of what Lauren Hamilton's life looks like today. The Takeaway's Alexandra Botti reports.
I'm in Lakewood, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland, with Lauren Hamilton and a group of her friends. It's Wednesday evening, and they've just finished their West Side Agnostics gathering. That's an Alcoholics and Narcotics Anonymous meeting. The group meets weekly in a library basement. But the night isn't over. After the meeting, we head across the street.
I'm Dan Crack. We're on Madison Avenue in Lakewood, and we're walking into the Bion Club, which is a sober social club. And we're going to see how that goes.
All right, lead the way.
All right. After you.
This is the Believe It or Not, or Bion Club.
So the club space is meant to provide a forum for people who maybe aren't as into the God concept that's really prevalent in AA meetings, especially in the Cleveland area.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's a big push in the political sphere here in Ohio because of the opioid crisis, and we're stepping into the gap, and that's the gap between what happens at the end of an AA meeting and what happens out on the street when you walk outside. I'm Billy C., and I'm the president of the Bion Club. I'm also one of the founders of Westside Agnostics.
It's not hard to find Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous meetings in the Cleveland area and across Ohio. There are more sober and recovery clubs than ever, too, where people can go for educational programs or just to socialize. But it's hard to find a setting that doesn't incorporate religion. So the Bion Club was born.
So when we were looking for a name, we asked Campbell.
And Campbell is who?
Friends from the West Side Agnostic Meeting, and he's a punster. And so he gave us a list of all these names, and Bion Club won.
Is there a runner-up?
Yeah, the runner-up was Drunk Tank. So, yeah, and it might be a little hard to rent a place that you're going to name Drunk Tank. Right. But the Bion Club is we are not an agnostic sober club. We're a sober club. We're a recovery club. And we don't want any. We want everybody. We want your Catholics and your Protestants and your evangelicals and your atheists. We'll take anyone. We have Rich the Witch, who's one of our pagan members. And, you know, the Bion Club is a good all-purpose name that says that you don't have to come here and expect a prayer meeting.
Wait, so let me ask, have you all sought out this type of thing before and not found it?
For whatever reason, notwithstanding that we're in a neighborhood or a city that has probably more meetings per square mile than anywhere in the country. It's a very densely packed area in the first place, and it's also historically very Irish Catholic, and so there's a lot of people in AA around here, and for whatever reason, there's not been a club here historically. And I mean, I think that's a big part of it, is just the geography. But I also do think that some of the clubs tend to have a little bit of a different vibe than we're envisioning here. We're hoping that this will be a younger, more open-minded set, perhaps, than you'd inquire at some of those other clubs. And, at least that's the premise we're starting with. But whoever shows up is more than welcome.
Lauren says it's been hard to secure a place to rent. The first space she and her friend showed me actually fell through. But the group remains undeterred. And for Lauren, being involved with the club is an exciting piece of her future.
I plan on serving on various committees for the club. And then ideally, once the club is actually up and running, I'll be teaching yoga and 12-step recovery classes/meetings at the club location. And it entails basically like a 45-minute yoga class and then a 45-minute 12-step meeting. I mean, for me, it's allowed me to work on, staying present, listening to my body. I can feel warning signs in my body, like depending on what emotional state I'm in. So I think it can be helpful for anyone in recovery.
Back in Dayton, April Arion's situation looks really different. Today, she is in Montgomery County Jail and faces charges related to her drug use in two different counties. One is a felony burglary charge in Clark County, which she told me about back in the spring.
For a burglary my boyfriend committed that I wasn't present for. It's a long story. But you see that a lot, especially with addicts. Boyfriends committing crimes and girlfriends just get charged for it too. So that's just like the way it goes.
At the time we spoke, April was out on bond. The other charge she is currently facing is for forging a check in Montgomery County.
Being an addict has a lot of repercussions with the legal system, so I can't go back for some of the things that I would have. I'd like to see some of those laws changed. Can't work with kids, can't. Pretty much the only fields you can work in as a violent felon with a degree is the drug counselor realm of things. I don't want to stay in that community for the rest of my life. And that's just me. A lot of people find a lot of gratitude working in the field, but I don't want the end of my line to end up on the other side of a rehab. And that's just me, personally. And will that ever change? I don't know, maybe. But I'll probably try to go to school and get an undergraduate in political science or something like that, English maybe. And try to go to law school someday. You can do that as a felon, a violent felon.
That's actually the path that Lauren took, returning to work as an attorney after getting clean. Her employer saw her through relapses, she says, and has supported her to this day. And now Lauren is coming up on a really big milestone.
On July 1st of this year, I'll have a year sober.
Relapse is common for people suffering from opioid addiction. Some studies put the relapse rate upwards of 80% after opioid detoxification. Lauren says she thinks she has relapsed about 30 times since her first opioid overdose in 2014.
I never, ever thought I would be able to say the word year in conjunction with the word sober. I'm very proud of myself. And it's just like, okay, it's just, it's a year, it's another day. It feels like a really important milestone to me.
Since we first met in the spring, Lauren is talking more about her past and about her future. She was the keynote speaker at a fundraiser for the Women's Recovery Center last month, where she found sobriety.
Thank you. So my name is Lauren Hamilton. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I use my full name because I feel like I have a duty to help reduce the stigma that surrounds addiction.
Yeah, I definitely want to keep doing things like that. I've actually applied to be a board member of the Adams Board here in Cuyahoga County, which is the Alcohol, Drug Addiction, Mental Health Services Board. We'll see if that pans out. I think it's important, to have people on the board that have been through addiction and recovery and treatment and all of that. And I like making decisions. So seems like a good fit. I'd actually say it's been a pretty transformative experience sharing my story with you. And then around the same time, you know, being asked to speak at the fundraiser for the Women's Recovery Center and sharing my story there. Those were kind of my first opportunities to share my story like that since I've actually been sober for a little bit of time now. I think it's helped me grow in my recovery to learn to not only accept myself, but to see my past as something that can help other people if I just share it. And it actually reminds me of something that is in the Alcoholics Anonymous big book, if I can read it to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something my friend Billy always reads. And it says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. So I think, you know, the whole experience has allowed me to see the value in sharing my story and in not living a life of shame. And I think that's so important, you know, and I want to do my part, which is why I, you know, sometimes give my whole name. Like when I spoke at the fundraiser for the Women's Recovery Center, I introduced myself to this room full of 200 people using my full name because I feel like I really can play a role in reducing the stigma around addiction. And I think that's so crucial. I think that most addicts and alcoholics just have so much shame. And I know that for me, every time I relapsed, the reason I kept using and kept relapsing is because I was just way too ashamed to ask anyone for help, to you know, let anyone know that I had failed.
Nearly 1 year of being sober has given Lauren some distance to reflect on how different her life feels now.
I cannot remember a time in my life where I trusted myself. So I really am starting to feel lately like I can trust myself. And because I can trust myself, I can extend trust to other people. And that whole experience has been so freeing for me. I think for just so much of my life, I acted really impulsively and reactively. So now I've kind of slowed down and I'm thinking things through and I can trust myself to make rational decisions and to act with my best interest in mind. You know, it just feels way more safe and secure and freeing to be able to trust. I'm no longer living in a state of fear, I'm living in a state of love.
We'll keep in touch with Lauren and April to find out how their lives continue to unfold. Lori, April's mom, tells me April will finish a recovery program in jail, and she hopes her daughter will be able to stay sober when she gets out. And as for Lauren, she's focused on celebrating her 1 year of sobriety. She says she'll go to an AA meeting, and she'll have some cake with her friends from the Bion Club. For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti in Ohio.
And we've been hearing from you about your experiences with life after overdose.
Hello, this is Christina from Hubbardston, Mass. The words of hope that I would share with those struggling from addiction are, addiction is a part of you, but it doesn't have to be the strongest part. Never stop striving.
Hi, this is Kathy from Dallas, Texas. And for anyone who is still struggling with addiction, what I would say to them is to never give up. You only have this day, and it's absolutely worth it.
Monica from Corvallis, Oregon. You deserve help, love, and understanding. You are worth loving. You are not a bad person. Life can be different. You might feel totally alone, but you aren't. You have made and you will make mistakes, but they don't need to define you.
This is Lauren in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm the son of an addict. As a child, parent, or friend of an addict, you must learn to balance the duty of telling the hard truth when it needs to be told with the essence of compassion, always keeping your heart open to the reality and the fullness of this person's experience. This seems impossible, but it's the only way to not get dragged down with them.
Hi, this is Ashley Dodge from Denver, Colorado. I just like to say that it's not easy and it's never over. There will be relapses and you'll feel isolated, but it's important to surround yourself with supportive people and avoid temptation. I hope you put yourself in the best place for success.
Remember, there are resources out there if you or someone you know is struggling with addiction. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has a 24-hour free, confidential, and bilingual referral and information helpline for people and families. And that's 1-800-662-4357 or 1-800-662-HELP. Again, that's 1-800-662-4357. Thanks so much for sharing your stories with us. And you can share your words of hope and wisdom for those struggling with opioid and other addiction by tweeting us at The Takeaway using the hashtag LifeAfterOverdose. Or call us and leave a message at 877-8MYTAKE. We'll include as many of your calls as possible on an upcoming special podcast episode with all of our stories out of Ohio this week. In the meantime, you can find the whole series at thetakeaway.org/LifeAfterOverdose. In April, comedian Rami Yusuf's sitcom Rami premiered on Hulu. The show is loosely based on his own life, and it follows the main character played by Rami as he tries to balance conflicting obligations to his family, religion, and friends. Most of the first season is set in the much maligned state of New Jersey, where Rami grew up. And he told me he disagrees with all the hate.
You know, I think it's very unwarranted. I think New Jersey is one of the greatest places. I think it's arguably the best state in the country. Part of it is its proximity to New York. But I like that it's not New York. And I like that there's, you know, where I grew up, it's really quiet. It's not too far from the noise. But you can kind of just be a person, be near some trees, see the foliage and whatnot.
This Saturday, Rami's busy 2019 continues with his first HBO stand-up special, Feelings, an hour-long set that finds him disregarding plenty of social norms.
I have really prejudiced thoughts. There are things I think that are wrong. Like, I get really upset every time I get a white Uber driver. Devastated. Like, I look down on my phone, I see the little white face, and I'm just like, I'm gonna be late.
The special also includes jokes about some of the famous men accused of sexual harassment and assault, like R. Kelly and Harvey Weinstein. And when I sat down with Rami this week, I asked him how he finds humor in these very taboo topics.
Regardless of what the situation is, it's, you know, our job to try and find a way to laugh about something in it. And so for me, the key has always been, what is the most introspective thing for me within this situation? So if I make a joke about Harvey, if I make a joke about Jussie Smollett, it's not really about them. It's more about where I fit in within that narrative and what is what they're going through or what is what they're doing. How does that reflect to where I am? And so I try to connect everything in that way.
You mentioned Jussie Smollett, and you just start out with like a pretty intense punch right off the top right here with Jussie's story. And do you feel pressured to feel like, and I guess this isn't a thing, but to be a woke comedian and sort of be within the lines of what that means? Or is it okay to have that joke right off the top about the Jussie Smollett case?
Do you think the joke is unwoke?
I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
But I could see people saying, oh my God, like, you know, this is a conspiracy about, you know, Chicago PD and all this other stuff.
Sure,
and I don't know. I mean, would some people argue that it shouldn't have been?
I don't know. No, of course. I mean, I think that that's always kind of the line with the show, with this. I mean, you kind of want that. You want something that most people will see, you know, what's really cool about why you're talking about it. But you need that contingency of people to be like, what? Why? No, that's not what I wanted. I mean, I think that anytime you're touching something that's real, you're going to get that reaction. But I do, again, like it's not about coming from a place that is confrontational or that is to be antagonistic or that is to be sensational. It's that's not the intent. The intent is like, how do we use this thing to dissolve what's going on in our own lives and how we, you know, where we're, and it sounds kind of like, it almost sounds like a little morally cheesy that I'm like, you know, this joke about rape can really teach us about, you know, who we are. But I mean, I think if you pull it off right, it should. But that's not the thing you lead with. I think you have to lead with it being funny. But I think you want it to be introspective, and I think that that's really important.
talked a little bit about making jokes surrounding folks like R. Kelly and Harvey Weinstein and Michael Jackson and sort of the Me Too movement. But more recently, someone who was directly involved in that, Louis C.K., has begun emerging back into the comedy scene and to, you know, in some instances, to standing ovations. Is cancel culture canceled in comedy when it comes to folks like Louis C.K.? Is there a shorter lifespan or for that type of thinking? Or is it just the way the comedy scene is, you think?
I think it depends. I mean, I think that saying the comedy scene is like saying the Muslim community. It's like, well, what are you talking about? What kind of Muslims? Are you talking about Arab Muslims? Are you talking about Black Muslims? It's a broad thing. So I think there are various comedy communities. And so Louis is very accepted in some. He's not accepted in others. And I think that, you know, from a comedic point of view, doing, you know, there's this really crazy thing that happens when you're doing stand-up in New York. You'll be on stage sometimes and you're right on the street, essentially, in a lot of these clubs, and you hear crazy stuff. So sometimes you're on stage and there is a massive fight going on outside. Sometimes there is a siren going on that won't leave. And when you're on stage, you have to address it. You have to say, hey, I hear that thing outside and now I'm going to get to my joke. My whole thing with Louis has always been just address the siren. You can't step on stage and act like
it never happened.
Because it's not even that like you owe us something. You just owe us recognition to say there's a siren, you know, and what was your part in it, and you don't have to say something specific, you just have to say something, and I find that to be the core of most people's frustration, which is how can I watch this guy when he's not acknowledging the thing that the rest of us hear, he's pretending like it's not. So there's this like sense of distrust, you know, and so, you know, that to me feels like what we're dealing with, and I personally, you know, I have a hard time watching someone who doesn't acknowledge the siren.
A few weeks ago, we had a professor of Asian American comedy on our show, and we were talking about the sort of rise in different portrayals of Asian Americans in comedy and getting to this place where they don't have to constantly respond to the typical tired racial stereotypes in their work, which I think is refreshing. And we were talking like about the Netflix special Always Be My Maybe, for example, and beyond. Is that becoming a reality for Middle Eastern and North African American comedians right now?
Yeah, pretty soon. Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, we did on my, I talk about it in my stand-up, but in my show, there is one episode that talks about terrorism, and it's from the perspective of a child. You know, so we see a kid in middle school, you know, during 9/11, and then the rest of the series doesn't talk about it. And I think we have one small conversation about Trump when I go to Cairo with my family members who they're actually pro-Trump. So I don't need to talk about those things to make a show. You know, I don't need to talk about these kind of tired tropes. Most of the real estate of my show is really dedicated to watching someone be introspective and kind of figure out what their code is on a moral level, which there's not really anything that's more universal than that. On top of it, we put, you know, the specifics of being Muslim and the language and kind of that experience. But even in that, there's some expository stuff that I have to go through, you know, that I have to start getting through. But, you know, hopefully as I make more seasons of my show, but hopefully as there are other shows that revolve around other Muslim experiences, we can just be weird. You know, we don't need to do the work of re-educating. We don't need to do the work of reframing. I have a little bit of work to do on that level. You know, when we tested the pilot for my show, because it opened in a mosque, test audiences thought it was Homeland, like in the same genre as Homeland.
Wow.
And they didn't realize it was a comedy until 10 minutes in when I was on a date with a girl named Chloe. And then they were like, oh, maybe it's funny. And so there's that work. And so I'm, you know, not ignorant to the fact that we're doing some reframing on a level. But I don't think that's going to be our work for too long.
Rami Youssef's stand-up special Feelings is out this Saturday on HBO. Rami, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Friday marks 50 years since the riots at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City's Greenwich Village. During the 1960s, the New York Police Department often conducted raids at queer-friendly places. Officers in the so-called Public Morals Unit would pat down gender non-conforming people in the bar to verify their anatomical sex and arrest those they found to be cross-dressing. Victoria Cruz, an activist who was at Stonewall, described these raids to WNYC earlier this month.
Yeah, they check if you were a boy or girl. They would run their hands behind their back, and once they hit a bra strap, they would pull the bra strap back and let it go. And it would, like, hurt them in the back, especially with those big hooks.
But at Stonewall on the night of June 28, 1969, the crowd resisted. When the paddy wagons arrived to take away the people under arrest, the scene turned violent. The uprising that night grew into the start of the modern LGBTQ civil rights movement. Earlier this month, the Queen's Theater and the One Minute Play Festival collaborated to present the Stonewall 50 Plays, which featured one play for every year since the riot. I spoke with Dominic D'Andrea, the artistic director of the One Minute Play Festival and the Stonewall 50 Plays, and Patrick Morgan, an actor and writer who played Marsha P. Johnson in the Stonewall 50. And I started by asking Dominic why this format, 50 short plays, was a good way to tell the story of Stonewall.
It seemed to be the most inclusive and the most obvious way that we could get a large cross-section of our population into to participate with us.
And then tell us a little bit about the types of queer stories that you were looking for, that you wanted to highlight in these 50
plays.
Well,
it's funny, like our initial thing about the work is investing in people. So we found the artists that we really care about and asking them to tell stories from their perspectives. So inevitably, the result of that is that it is a deeply inclusive and intersectional collection of plays. We have plays that are from trans perspective and gender non-binary non-conforming perspectives and in Spanish language and in Korean and from intergenerational perspectives and any ways you can sort of think about the ways that intersectionality kind of works and looks like.
Patrick, you played transgender activist Marsha P. Johnson in a couple of the plays. Can you remind us who Marsha was and the role that she played in the queer rights movement?
Marsha P. Johnson was a transgender person who was one of the people who they think may have thrown the first brick in the moment. But she was definitely at the forefront, along with Sylvia Rivera and Stormy DeLaverie, queer people of color who were there at the forefront of the Stonewall riots.
What did it mean for you to play her on stage?
So for me personally, it was me getting to hopefully do honor to my idol. Like, I look up to her as a person who's transitioning, and she was at the forefront of the movement. And I remember before going on, I just said a little silent prayer to her, like, I hope that I do you justice, because there's a play in there about her being canonized and going up to meet St. Peter, and then St. Peter fangirls, and then God comes over and is like, we are so honored to meet you, and we have decided to canonize you, and she deserves to be canonized because she and Sylvia Rivera went on to found STAR, which was helping transvestite queer kids on the street. Her work is incredible, and I owe a lot of debt of gratitude to her.
You mentioned trans people of color, Marsha P. Johnson among them. Why do you think a lot of that conversation about their role in the LGBTQ fight for civil rights and from Stonewall and beyond has often been lost?
I don't know. I think it's probably because queer people of color have been left out of the conversations for creating the art around those things, and it's not helping to feed into the culture and advance those narratives of people like Marsha P. Johnson. So I think as more voices come on board, then you'll have more representation and more honoring of history.
I'd love if one of you or both of you could read a part of one of the plays that you put on for the Stonewall 50.
Yeah. This is a play called Who Threw the First Brick? It's by Corinna Gus Schulenberg, who is a trans writer and very prominent voice in New York theater. Okay. You want it to be simple.
That's not what I want.
You want a clean beginning.
Not exactly, but I do want to know.
Who threw the first brick?
Or the first shot glass, whatever it was.
You want it to be the handsome white man.
That's for sure not what I want.
You want it to be Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera.
Well, I don't want them left out. That's for damn sure.
You want your heroines.
I want my history.
You want your plaques and your monuments.
More than that, I want the moment where it happened.
You want Stormy DeLaverie clubbed in the face.
I don't want any more violence against us.
You want her punching the cop back.
Closer, but...
You want when they hauled her into the van.
Yeah, and she turned to the crowd and yelled.
Why don't you guys do something?
Why don't you guys do something? Yeah, that's what I want.
That's powerful stuff. And the reading was equally powerful. I'm feeling it, literally. what stood out to both of you about that piece?
It's talking about the wants of someone and you have to figure it out. You can figure it out by a process of elimination. I don't want this. I don't want that. But you know what I do want? I want you guys to do something, whether it's trans women being killed or gay kids killing themselves from suicide. I want you to do something and make this okay.
Dominic. Yeah. I think for me, what struck me about this work is it speaks very directly to the continuum in history. It names the names. It invokes the spirit of those contributions. And it asks the sort of very present existential question, what now? What did this leave us with? And what do we do with that history and legacy? And what do we do to continue that momentum?
Yeah.
Does art, and in this case, theater specifically, does that help normalizing the everyday for transgender people? In other words, is the goal to ultimately be able to watch a play, and it's not, this is a transgender play, but this is a play that's really good that happens to center around the transgender experience or to happens to have trans leads in it. Is that ultimately the goal? Is that, would that be part of sort of moving this to more of a, you know, mundane conversation?
It's a beautiful what if.
Yes, it definitely is that, where I can go in for an audition as a trans person of color and audition for waitress number two or whatever, and it's not about me being trans. It's literally just me about being the waitress,
right.
You know? So you do have a lot more normalizing to do.
Dominic, how much of the work that you did with these plays was really meant to sort of correct the record or the mainstream narrative around Stonewall?
That's an interesting question. I think we thought about it as speaking to the continuum, where it was, where it is now, and where the community is going. So a lot of that is simply speaking names, and a lot of these plays did, as Patrick sort of mentioned, did speak those names. But the other thing it's correcting is it's locating queerness in perspectives of communities of color, of gender questioning individuals, of people who are English learned language or people who are not primarily English speaking. And I think when you locate those types of narratives and center them in those kind of perspectives, it gives us an opportunity to really look at the bigger picture and maybe correct some of the history, but also widen the lens on the narratives of queerness now. And I know intersectionality is such a buzzword in our culture, but what that means in real time is creating a cultural currency and visibility with those around us.
Dominic D'Andrea is the artistic director of the 1 Minute Play Festival and the Stonewall 50 Plays. And Patrick Morgan is an actor and writer who performed in the Stonewall 50. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for the day. I'm out on vacation next week, and we'll have WNYC's Arun Venugopal filling in for me. And we have a sad note from the Takeaway team. After 7 years, our beloved longtime senior producer, Ellen Frankman, is leaving the show. We'll miss her so much, but we're very excited for what she does next. Thank you, Ellen, for all you've done. And thank you for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.